Much of 20th century music has devoted itself to the search for new sounds, sounds outside the traditional lexicon of instruments and orchestrations. At the end of World War II, the magnetic tape recorder opened up a new universe of non-instrumental sounds. Laboratory signal generators, radio transmissions, car horns, and human voices could be captured and combined in a genre sometimes called musique concrète. Sounds could be filtered, reversed, sped up, and slowed down. They could be spliced, mixed, and looped. But one aspect of sound remained stubbornly inaccessible. Volumes and timbres could be adjusted, but it was very difficult to make rapid and subtle changes to them over time. In the early 60s, two Americans, Don Buchla and Robert Moog, independently developed the voltage-controlled synthesizer. Author and musician Craig Anderton remembers his first encounter with a Moog, a daunting pile of electronic modules that had to be plugged together with patch cords.
You know, it was a huge collection of modules and lots of patch cords. It would take you hours to come up with something. And once you had it, you had to write down all the control settings and all the patch cord positions, because if you ever wanted to get that sound back again, it was impossible unless you had really taken, you know, very, very detailed notes. But it was like the ultimate sonic erector set. It was just an incredible tool for somebody who's interested in sound.
The classic Moog is a collection of rectangular modules mounted in a black folding road case. An oscillator module produces a tone. A filter module shapes the timbre of that tone by emphasizing different harmonics. An amplifier module controls the volume. Each module can be adjusted with knobs, but they can also be controlled by electrical voltages from other modules, voltages that can change automatically over time. An envelope generator module can control the amplifier to make notes. It can control the filter to produce dynamically changing timbres. It can control the pitch of the oscillator. And it can be controlled by other modules in an endlessly complex network of automatic processes. This is Silver Apples of the Moon by Morton Subotnick, a landmark in electronic music, created on a Buchla Model 100 synthesizer. Buchla designed his instrument for Subotnick, who had been working at the San Francisco Tape Music Center. The Tape Music Center later moved to Mills College in Oakland, where we visited recently with studio coordinator John Bischoff. Now, this is a sort of a sorry-looking relic here. I mean, it looks like Grandpa's radio pulled out of the closet.
Yeah, it's very dear to our hearts because this machine, this Buchla 100, the first Buchla 100 made by Don Buchla, he still lives in Berkeley, was made for the San Francisco Tape Music Center. And if you look at the touch keypad unit here, it says San Francisco Tape Music Center Incorporated on it. I think it was made about 1964. It has some claim to being the first analog synthesizer ever made, voltage-controlled one. And I think this is the white noise generator, which you can see is a prototype, because unlike a printed circuit board, it's tack-wired in space, as they say, sculptural method.
That looks like a sculptural rat's nest.
Yeah, so which is quite exciting, because you can see where maybe Don was, you know, thinking the circuit out and building it at the same time and maybe adjusting it.
It says, it's written on the back of the panel in pencil, be careful. Several wires were, and then the rest of the message is lost.
That's right. That's great. No, be careful.
While Buchla was collaborating with Subotnick on the West Coast, Robert Moog on the East Coast was working with a musician named Walter, later Wendy Carlos. In 1968, Wendy Carlos used a Moog synthesizer to create one of the most popular classical recordings of all time, Switched on Bach. The record was a synthesizer tour de force, but it had a paradoxical effect. Unlike Buchla's instruments with their buttons and touchpads, this synthesizer was played with a keyboard. Suddenly, the synthesizer looked like something familiar, like an electric organ. Craig Anderton.
It always mystified me that the main application that people wanted for synthesizers was to imitate the sounds of existing instruments. I think that a lot of people misinterpreted the success of Switched on Bach and thought, oh, well, if we imitate instruments, we will do well. Whereas actually what Wendy Carlos did was interpret Bach's pieces. And yes, there was some imitative synthesis in there, but a lot of it was more impressionistic, and people sort of missed that point. So although there were some people who were doing, really synthesized type music like Morton Subotnick working with the Buchla synthesizer, it amazed me how rapidly the whole synthesizer scene de-evolved into people trying to sound like pianos.
The ultimate sonic Erector set quickly gave way to the keyboard synthesizer. The Mini Moog eliminated those pesky patch cords altogether in favor of a simple fixed architecture with a built-in keyboard. It was a runaway hit. But that success was dwarfed by the introduction in 1984 of the Yamaha DX7.
It was about as much of a complete break with previous methods of synthesis as you can imagine. About the only thing they had in common was a keyboard.
The DX7 relied on a new technology called FM synthesis, developed in the 70s by Stanford professor John Chowning. Chowning had been unable to interest American manufacturers, but Yamaha, already the world's largest instrument maker, decided to take a chance. To get the precise tunings required by FM, the DX7 used all digital oscillators. Craig Anderton.
Well, the DX7 had several things going for it. First of all, it was under $2,000. It was light and portable, and it was entirely digitally generated. So there was a sort of quality of sound, a kind of crispness, a bell-like quality that was just not possible to obtain with analog synthesizers. It could also obtain a much wider range of sounds because of the digital architecture in there. And it could do some pretty good imitative synthesis, as well as really clangorous kind of ring modulator classical sounds. And even though people had a hard time programming it, that didn't matter so much because they weren't programming analog synthesizers either. And a lot of talented programmers were coming up with sounds for it that you could buy over the counter.
The Mini Moog had sold 10,000 units. The DX7 sold 250,000. It changed music.
There was the advent of, shall we say, cheap music, where people wanted to do soundtracks without having to hire an orchestra, or they wanted to get music for a 30-second spot without having to hire a bunch of musicians. They could get a synthesizer player to come in. The producer could say, get me a cello sound, and it would be good enough for the application at hand.
The explosion of processor power in the 80s produced an avalanche of digital keyboards vying to be the next DX7. Wavetable synthesizers replaced oscillators with digitally recorded fragments of actual sounds. Sample playback keyboards stored actual notes. The production and sale of sound libraries for these instruments became a big business. The modern keyboard synthesizer is more versatile, more playable, and, dare I say it, more lifelike than ever before. But there are still a few people who just don't like them.
I'm not surprised that the digital keyboards control the market. They are mass market oriented instruments.
Ed Herman is a Bay Area musician with a stubborn attachment to a modular analog synthesizer called a Surge. Designed by Serge Chirapnin in the mid-70s and still produced in small numbers today, the Surge breaks down the classic modular architecture into even more fundamental electrical functions.
The analog synthesizers are really oriented to people who want to take the time to understand what's going on with these little beasts. They're complicated. They're not, you can't just take one out of the box and plug it in and immediately get a sound that is gratifying and predictable. You have to study it. You have to understand what's going on with it. You have to explore it. They're not oriented to things like pop music, which, at least in the current phase, puts a high value on repeatability and predictability and doing the same thing over and over for a show with a band. Whereas that's what the digital keyboards do. That's the whole nature of the presets. You push a button, it sounds like a bad violin. You push another button, it sounds like a bad bassoon.
In his improvisations with other musicians, Herman plays the Surge without a keyboard, just like the old Buchla 100.
I used to think of it almost like an elaborate irrigation system, you know, because the waves are just moving along like waves of water, and you've got a little rivulet over here, you've got some over here, and then they come together here, and they bump into each other here, and they set up this oscillation here, and you can transport that oscillation over here, and you've got this whole complex web of waves bumping into each other, and then you just pick out certain points of it and send those points out to the amplifier at the end, and you listen to that part.
So it's really more of a wave sculpture.
It's a wave sculpture, exactly. Yeah, which on the elemental level, that's all the universe is.
Whoa.
Yeah, the path that synthesis would have taken would have been interesting if it had gone down Buchla's path more than the one that people use with the Moog gear.
But the evolution of the synthesizer isn't over. Craig Anderton predicts that the personal computer will be the ultimate synthesizer, with software that provides both modular programmability and the playability of keyboards and presets. In the meantime, he says, young musicians are rediscovering the analog synthesizer.
I think what really has made analog synthesis come alive is the whole generation of kids now who are rediscovering it. And all of them were born into a world that already had synthesizers. I mean, the synthesizer essentially made its debut in 1964. So now we have a whole generation of people who are raised on synthesizers and don't see any particular reason to sound like instruments that already exist. They use the synthesizer for what it does best, which is, you know, create its own voice.
I'm John Rieger.